Coming up next on Tech News Weekly, we go hands-on, sort of, with a review of the iPhone X. Also, why The Economist is so dang good at Snapchat, why technology's biggest companies took a trip to Washington, and students are sussing out the bots on Twitter so you don't have to. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Weekly, Episode 5, recorded Thursday, November 2nd, 2017.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Grasshopper. Stay connected and run your business from your mobile phone with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, visit trygrasshopper.com/twit.
And by Grammarly. Download Grammarly, the intelligent writing app, for free by visiting getgrammarly.com/twit.
Welcome to Tech News Today. This is Tech News Weekly.
Yeah, but it's today, so that kind of works.
I'm Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell. Oh, man, that hurts. It hurts to hear that out loud.
It does.
But, I mean, let's be honest. It's today in my heart.
Yes. And we, we're weekly now, which means hopefully you're more excited to talk about the tech news. So should we get right to it?
Let's do it.
So whether you're a YouTuber getting your dad fired over your first look at the iPhone, or your regular Apple reviewer given only a few minutes with the new phone, there are certainly no shortage of iPhone X reviews out there. We are excited to talk to Mark Spoonhauer, editor-in-chief of Tom's Guide and Laptop Mag. Welcome to the show, Mark.
No, oh, thanks for having me.
So first things first, how long have you had your review unit?
Well, right now it's all a blur. I think we're going on 4 days now. We picked it up on Monday.
Yeah. So you said it's in your review, your main review, you guys tested the battery, you tested the screen, but you said it's striking not just what Apple added, but mostly what they left behind. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. It actually reminds me, I don't know if you guys remember, the very first time that Steve Jobs showed off the original iPad. And so he sat down on the couch and he was really talking about how they were trying to remove the obstacles between you and your content. And this sort of reminds me of that in a different way. Like, so now they're getting rid of the bezels, which everyone has complained about. The Galaxy S8 obviously got there first, and other phones since then. But there's just people who are just wedded to the iOS ecosystem and Apple, and they've been waiting for something that really looks like a new design. And this does that, because you're getting a fairly big 5.8 inch screen, and something that's easy to use in one hand. You know, so I have it right here. And I'm one who's always carrying the iPhone 7 Plus. And I like having the big screen, but I hate the fact that it's actually bulging out of my pocket.
Now, what do you say about the display? Because, I mean, this is the first OLED display on an iPhone. I didn't realize this because I do a show on called All About Android. We talk about Android. So, of course, the Pixel 2 has been a big discussion with OLED and blue tilt. And the other night on the show, our guest said, well, the iPhone X, apparently some people are seeing this here as well. Did you notice this? What do you think about the display itself?
But we're definitely not noticing the color shift, but what we are noticing is that actually it's a lot brighter than other OLED panels. And I think what's ironic about this is that Samsung is reportedly making the OLED screen for the iPhone X, and yet this is actually brighter. It has wider viewing angles and more natural looking colors. So what you're showing right there is one of the photos that we took for the review, and that was outdoors. The other thing that's worth noting is that right now I have the screen turned down pretty far in order for you guys to see it. And that's partly because the screen brightness is over 540 nits.
Wow.
Which is brighter than the other phones that we've tested. Obviously, you can see that I'm having a little issue with the interface. And we'll get into that, because there is a learning curve in terms of getting around the iPhone X. But so far, just in terms of the screen quality, we think it's the best OLED panel on a phone yet.
So, yeah, let's get right into that. I mean, what is the learning curve? Why is it hard, difficult to navigate?
Yeah, well, it's partly because there's no home button, right? So you have to get used to these gestures and just like something that very simple, like checking your battery, right? So a lot of people are talking about the notch that's right up here. And it is a little bit of an eyesore, but it's not just about that. It's the fact that you have to swipe down from the top here just to look at something like your battery percentage. Because I was looking for a way to enable that in settings. And as it turns out, you can't do that. But as you also notice, that's how you access Control Center now too. You have to swipe down from the top in order to see that. The other thing is just how you get around apps too. So if you want to, let's say, open the app switcher, there's no home button to double click now. You have to swipe up from the bottom of the screen. Let's see. So you got it right there. See? And then to close apps, this is one of the things that actually annoys me. Like, you would think that just like the iPhone today, you would just swipe up on one of these apps to close it. But that's actually not how it works. You press and hold, and then you swipe up.
Yeah, I don't like that as much.
Yeah,
I hate when you add an extra step to something that used to be simpler. You know what I mean? Right. I feel like we see this time and time again.
Because you don't really have to get rid of those, right? I mean, you don't, like, it's not wasting battery. They're not running in the background, those apps.
No. So I think, right, you don't have to force close apps. Mm-hmm. But if you want to, it's just a little bit annoying that they added the extra step. I know why they did it, because when you want to basically, you know, open the app switcher, that gesture is what does it. And they didn't want people to just like keep doing that and then swipe an app off the screen. But I still think they could trust us. So,
now this is Apple. So user making the decision sometimes doesn't fall into their playbook. So obviously there's a little bit of a learning curve because they are changing the way that you interact with this. But is it an improvement? Because, I mean, with any change, it's weird at first and then you get used to it and then it's just the way it is. Or if this is someone's first iPhone, they're going to get used to the way it is because they have nothing to compare it to. Is it a change for the better?
I think that over time that most iPhones are probably going to go in this direction. Like once you don't have the bezels anymore, I don't think they're going to be bringing the home button back, right? So there's going to be like a whole generation of iPhone users who are going to get used to the iPhone X, and I suspect that this technology is going to trickle down and the gestures along with it. So yes, so there is a little bit of a learning curve, but it is starting to become second nature for me, especially for things like Control Center and exiting apps and that sort of thing. I think part of the issue is that my everyday phone right now is still an iPhone 7 Plus. Mm-hmm. And so I have to train my brain based on what phone I'm holding.
So you did review it also against the 8. What would you say to people? I mean, who needs the 10 and who needs the 8?
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about need, then the iPhone 10 is not for you.
Right.
All right, good point.
It's about want. And I think, you know, the big reason is the design. We want something like the screen itself, right? Because I really do like the natural colors of the LCD that the iPhone 8 and the 8 Plus have. But there's something about, there's this Goldilocks effect. Like the iPhone 10 is just right because you get a big screen and something that's almost the same size as the regular iPhone 8. And when you put a 4.7-inch screen next to a 5.8-inch one, the other one just seems antiquated at that point.
Mm-hmm. And so what about the battery life? I know you guys did some battery testing. What did you think of the battery life of the 10?
It was good, but definitely not best in class. We got about 10 hours and 40 minutes on our web surfing battery test, and we do that for all of our smartphones. So as you can see there, it's sort of in the middle of the pack. Right, so it's definitely above average and better than the iPhone 8. And if you think about what Apple promised, they said it's going to be 2 hours better than the iPhone 7. And based on our testing, that was almost the case. But as you can see there, there's a couple of phones that last a little bit longer. And we're a little bit different than other outlets because a lot of them just say, like, anecdotally, this is what I got based on mixed usage. We are very scientific about it. We set the brightness at 150 nits and we calibrate the screens. We have our own battery test, and it surfs the web over LTE. We also try to use the same network, too. So in this case, we use T-Mobile, which in our test, it might sound weird, but we found them to offer the best battery life.
So it's lasts longer than the 8, but not as long as the 8 Plus.
Yeah, so above average. Like the iPhone 8 Plus lasts a little bit longer, at least based on our test. But the one thing to keep in mind is that when you have a web surfing battery test, what's on the screen most of the time is a white background. And OLED panels really excel when you have blacks on the screen because they don't have to use as much power, actually no power, in order to show the darker colors and especially like perfect blacks and that sort of thing. So it's going to vary based on what you have on the display, but we do our apples to apples comparison, and other OLED screens lasted a little bit longer.
And I don't think we can talk about the iPhone X without discussing a little bit your experience with Face ID. Do you have an evil twin to compare your experience with, or how did that work for you?
Actually, I do. Oh, okay. No, I do. I have an identical twin. We did not try it yet. But he looks a little bit different than I do, so I know, okay. I'm pretty sure that he wouldn't be able to fool it.
I mean, some of the videos that I've seen, I mean, it was really hard. Granted, I don't know these people, you know, these identical twins, but it would be really hard for me to tell what is different between the two, yet the phone was able to determine that.
Yeah, so I would say it's very sophisticated and it works really well, especially I was impressed that, like, just using it in bed and in the dark, the fact that it was able to recognize my face and then log me in. And I think that in certain ways it does surpass Touch ID, especially like as someone who like works and uses their phone at the same time and eats lunch at the same time. If you have anything on your fingers, whether it's crumbs or sand or anything else, or sweat, you can't log into your phone, right, when you're using Touch ID. So this eliminates that issue with Face ID. So I do give Apple credit. And I think that facial recognition is more sophisticated than what the Galaxy Note 8 has. There's a reason why they had to use both facial recognition and iris recognition. It's almost like, we don't have something that's great, so here's a couple of options. Right? But there are some downsides to Face ID, and one of those is speed.
So it's not that fast.
So it really depends on, like, so I'm a power user, right? And I'm opening my phone, like, hundreds of times a day, more than that's probably healthy. But in those, what I timed is something along the lines of about a second and a half to get into your phone versus less than a second for a Touch ID. And the reason is that with Touch ID, you could just lay your finger on the button and get into your phone without even having to fire up the display, right? So on the iPhone X, you have to wake up the display. Even if you raise to wake the phone, it still takes a second for the screen to pop on, and then you can start, you know, swiping up. But one tip that I have for folks when they get the iPhone X is that don't wait for that little icon to unlock at the top of the screen that tells you that Face ID has worked. Just start swiping up because it's already trying to recognize your face, and I almost never tripped up the iPhone X that way. So it's a nice little tip.
I was going to say just take a deep cleansing breath while you're waiting.
Yeah.
Maybe ask yourself, do I need to open my phone 100 times a day?
Yeah, it takes some me time.
Yeah, exactly.
One second every single time you get into your phone, that adds up to a lot of me time.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Mark,
I know it sounds nerdy, but
that's a good tip.
But I do think
it adds up.
I do think that the True Depth camera offers a lot of other cool features, and you know, we can get into Animoji, but I'm also curious to see what developers do with it too.
Yeah. So you like the camera? It's been taking some good pictures, and you've been sending some Animoji to people?
Yeah. We actually did a face-off between the iPhone X and the Pixel 2 in our limited amount of time with both phones, and they tied. So they both excel in different areas. So what you can see right there is that was a portrait shot that we took, not with the front-facing camera, the back camera. And one thing that we think that the iPhone X, one area where it excels, there's actually two things that you're seeing in that image. I actually like the warmer skin tones from the iPhone X. And also the bokeh effect from the dual lenses is more natural on the iPhone X than it is on the Pixel 2. And that's because Google is using software. They're processing the image after the fact. But the other thing that you're showing right there is me at a local bar. And there's a huge difference in low light performance between both phones. You see how the candle is blown out with the iPhone X, and then it's not on the Pixel 2?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it looks good. It's definitely got a little bit of grain in both issues and in both samples. But, yeah, I would agree. Yeah. You get a lot more depth of information on the Pixel 2 comparatively in the low light.
When we do photo face-offs, like, we really try to declare a winner because, frankly, it's just more fun and you get more comments. But in this case, like, we really went back and forth, and it was a dead heat between both phones. But I do think that Apple has a little bit of an edge here in imaging because you get a 2x optical zoom. And you don't get that with the Google Pixel 2, but you do with the Galaxy Note 8.
Hmm. Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us. Mark is the editor-in-chief of Tom's Guide and Laptop Mag and is M. Spoonhour on Twitter. We look forward to reading more of your hardware reviews. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Take care. Really appreciate it. Have a good night.
After the break, think you're too old for Snapchat? Think yes. again. Oh. The Economist uses Snapchat, and The Economist is 174 years old. before we get to that, let's take a minute to thank Grasshopper. Grasshopper is a virtual phone system designed for entrepreneurs. Here's how it works. Just like your regular phone system, you don't have to learn anything new. And you can use the phones that you already have. You do not have to purchase any new hardware. So if you're starting up your business and you already have phones, this is the service for you. It's quick. You can get started right away. They have an iOS and an Android app. And then callers can reach you wherever you are, just on whatever phone you're using, whether it's a Pixel 2, an iPhone 10, an iPhone 4, whatever it is, they can reach you on it. Grasshopper allows you to keep your existing number so you can maintain your brand. And then when you make a call, your client sees your Grasshopper caller ID, not your personal phone number, so you can keep those separate. All you have to do is select a toll-free number. Toll-free numbers make you look professional. It can be local, which is always good, and record a custom greeting and add multiple extensions for your business. And you can set up department and employee extensions. You can use custom call forwarding. You can forward to any phone in the world. So whoever you're working with, wherever they are, you can forward their Grasshopper number to them. You can get voicemails emailed to you as audio attachments. You can also send and receive SMS text messages from your business number. So over 250,000 people are happy Grasshopper customers, and you can join them today. Plans start at just $12 a month. You have a 30-day money-back guarantee. Turn your smartphone into a business line with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, go to trygrasshopper.com/twit. That's trygrasshopper.com/twit, and we thank Grasshopper for their support. I did a little scrolling on the Snapchat chat discover tab this morning. Headlines I saw first were, what does your eye color say about you? Mm. Also, I only ate pizza for a week, and 16 signs that your sports bra is all wrong. But there among the BuzzFeeds and the Daily Mails is The Economist, the storied publication that's been around since 1843. And has done surprisingly well on Snapchat in the past year. Our guest today, Lucy Rohr, is the Snapchat editor for The Economist. Welcome to the show, Lucy.
Hi, Megan.
So thanks for coming on. Let's take a look at this week's Snapchat story. I recorded my screen. Yeah. It's about plastics. And I think we have the video of it. There we go.
Oh, yeah. I love this snap.
So I watched this morning and I couldn't help thinking of The Godfather, like, you know, one word for you, plastics. So now it's like the next generation is explaining why plastics isn't good for you and using Snapchat to do it. Is this pretty emblematic of the content that you guys are serving up on Snapchat?
Yeah, I would say so. I feel like one of the things that we're trying to do, The Economist in the magazine and kind of elsewhere that it lives, is all about spotting trends and explaining what they mean to people. And obviously plastic is something I think that this age group already know is pretty bad news for the environment. But we were trying to bring a bit more of a kind of economist spin to it. And we don't just talk about the environmental problems that plastic brings. We also talk about some of the ways in which it's a remarkable substance, some of the ways in which it can potentially be better for the environment. And we also, the way that we kind of kick off the whole edition is by talking about, if you imagine a museum of the future, what would the objects be from our period? The Anthropocene, as some people refer to it, and we come up with plastic as one of them. So, yeah, I mean, we tend to try and go with subjects which are going to be relevant and relatable for this audience. We try and frame them in that way, but we are also trying to bring, and I think our best editions bring, that economist reporting and some of our DNA to subjects that feel at home on that platform.
So you did, how well do you know the U.S. presidents? That was right to coincide with Donald Trump's inauguration. Yeah. So it was just 3 or 4 months after you started being on Snapchat. And you said that it reached more readers in a week than TheEconomist.com does in a month. Was that very surprising to you and others at The Economist?
That was our best performing edition of all time. But there are so many users on the platform to begin with, so that the numbers that we tend to see are pretty vast compared maybe to, I mean, The Economist, I think, lands on about 1 million doorsteps every every week, and a lot of our editions are getting that number of views. So I think it's sort of a reflection of the size of the platform, and also hopefully that we're doing something right.
Well, yeah, not just the size of the platform, but of the audience that is actually there. I mean, you know, I have to imagine the Snapchat audience kind of skews younger, let's say, than the print edition of the magazine.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, what do you see from the users, from the users of that platform that are engaging with this content? Like, how do you have to, I don't know, form this content so that it appeals to them without kind of pandering to that audience?
Well, one of the things that Snapchat told us before when we were sort of at the concept phase, before we'd actually gotten onto the platform, and this has been completely borne out by the year or so of experience that we've had up there, is that talking down to a younger audience just won't work. And I think that instances, I would like to think that we've really been pretty good at that most of the time. But if we do dumb things down, on the rare occasions that we might have done that, I think we get punished for it. I think that, so that's one thing that I would say about that. Mark, can you, I sort of feel like I've kind of lost the question, if you don't mind.
No. I think you answered that. I mean, it's obviously a different type of audience that you get through there. And you know, I think when you're taking a legacy brand and, you know, content that you're already formulating around one delivery mechanism, say at a magazine or even different social networks, like that's what I'm kind of fascinated with, is this trend towards creating different ways to deliver the same content in all of these different ways. I mean, it sounds like a lot of work, but obviously it's working for Snapchat. Are you doing this on other platforms, and is it working as well in other ways?
We are doing it on other platforms. I mean, we've had like a big Facebook presence for some time. We're also on Instagram. We're on Line. But from my experience on Snapchat, I think it is actually a lot of work, because there are parts of our voice that translate really well for the platform, and then there are bits of what we do that probably don't. So the really dry, abstract stuff that we might cover in the paper, it's not particularly visual, and obviously Snapchat is first and foremost visual, much the same way that Instagram is for that matter. But just talking about Snapchat, we want to think about things that can, you know, are going to work visually. But then we also, and I was talking with Megan about this previously, when we were sort of ramping up to getting on the platform, we spent quite some time thinking about the specific bits of our voice that would work well for both the platform, the audience, so the sort of rough demographic, and these 10-second disappearing videos. I mean, it's a very specific amount of time that you've got people for. And that was a really interesting exercise, because, as I said, there are parts of our voice that work, and then there are parts of our voice that don't work. The bits that work are, and I think that really they probably work across all of the different social media platforms off the top of my head, and the bits that work are our acting as a sort of trusted filter. So obviously there's a ton of news out there now more than ever. I mean, Megan, you were saying that you were looking at the Discover front pages this morning, and you've got news coming from every single which way, whether you're our age, whether you're 13, whether you're 22, a lot of noise. We like to think, both in the paper and on this platform, that we're a kind of filter for that noise. So the President's Edition is a good example of that. We're not just going to tell you about, you know, why you should be worried or not about Donald Trump being inaugurated. We're also going to tell you sort of what you should be looking forward to, and we're going to give you some history and some context. And that's something that we've done in the paper. I don't know if we've done it for 174 years, but we've done it for a very long time. Another part of our voice I feel that works well is something that we have done for 174 years, and that's campaigning on causes. So The Economist was set up to in response to the Corn Laws in 1843, as Megan mentioned. But since then, we've championed all sorts of different liberal progressive causes. So gay marriage, legalization of drugs. We think that prostitution should be decriminalized. And we thought, when we were sort of working out, well, what bits of us are going to work for this younger audience in particular, being a sort of champion of progressive causes and also explaining why we are and why those are, here we go, thanks, you brought up the what was the war on drugs, which is something that we originally editorialized on that back in 1988 on legalizing drugs. And so these are subjects which we think, a tone that we think has an appeal for a younger audience. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is that we're kind of a trend spotter. So I can see you've brought up the North Korea edition. This was the second edition that we published when we went up on the platform, and that was back in October of last year. And for me, again, this felt very economist-y because, you know, North Korea was in the news, but it wasn't dominating headlines the way that it has done for the past 6 months or so in particular. So this felt like it was kind of on people's radar, but we were putting it really front and center. And the way that we framed that on Snapchat for this age group was how scared should you be of North Korea? Now that feels sort of like old hat, but last October it felt like we were covering something that not everybody else was covering. And we were bringing, this important perspective to a young audience. And by framing it as how scared you should be, that's something we've found out over the past year, that they're sort of subjects which provoke a morbid interest or fear tend to do quite well if we've got that sort of thing on the cover. So anyway, hopefully that kind of answers your question.
Absolutely. So as someone who's been creating content, I know you've been creating content for decades, and you know, we have too. When Snapchat first became popular and there were people, you know, putting content up there, my first thought was like, but then it disappears. And I'm just, you know, I'm even though we used to do a daily show, we put content out and it basically disappears. Like it's, you can find it on YouTube, but it's the idea that it is somewhere. What happens to your content after you're done with it? And is that an issue? Where do you feel like I'm putting all this work into something that's going to disappear after today?
You know, I never thought about that until you just said it now. It's this sort of philosophical thought that I hadn't really given to what we're doing. At the moment, it really does just live up there for a week. We are thinking about ways that we might be able to repurpose it on some of our other platforms. But for the time being, really, it's because the format for Snapchat is so specific, it really doesn't easily translate to, you know, if we said, oh, we really like this fact or fiction, it's like a feature that we have in all of these editions. If we said, okay, we really like these, let's try and put a few of these, in a few months' time, let's say that a video is being made and we have a fact or fiction from a few months back. Could we put that in there? I mean, the format is different. I think it'd be more a case of like taking the content and the design concept that we've often come up with on Snapchat and applying that rather than actually just, you know, reusing the snap itself. So I think that there are learnings, which is a terrible jargony word to use, but there are definite takeaways in terms of tone of voice and visual identity that we're probably playing around with on this platform that we can experiment with and see if they're sort of going to work and be a good fit on different platforms. But right now, yeah, I'm just zen. We're making these additions and after a week, that's it.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I don't know why that is so hard for me. But yeah, so what's next? Like augmented reality? Can you put like Kim Jong-un in your living room?
Oh, God,
please make that happen. Yeah.
Oh goodness, I hate to think. What's next for me, or what's next for our Snapchat offering?
I guess, are you guys looking at new technologies, or is this, are you just kind of focusing on Snapchat at this point?
Well, as I said, we have established presences on other social media platforms. And I think that probably like most publishers, we're always interested in experimenting if it makes sense to us. For Snapchat for the time being, I think it will be just that. It will be ongoing experimentation. I definitely don't think that we've kind of cracked the formula for The Economist on Snapchat. But yeah, in terms of sort of other stuff, I mean, you know, Snapchat wasn't Snapchat Discover didn't exist 2 years ago, to my knowledge. So who knows? Your guess, in fact, your guess is probably a far better informed one than mine.
Well, that's what I think. You'll have this, the augmented reality Snapchat hot dog in the next issue of The Economist. That's what I foresee.
Yeah, so you're seeing that like, yeah, we'll start taking stuff from Snapchat and you're going to open up your hard copy of The Economist and this sort of like holographic image is going to hover over it. But my parents would love that when they got their magazine delivered to them.
Well, Lucy, thank you so much for joining us. Lucy Rohr has been working at The Economist for a decade and is now the Snapchat editor. You can subscribe to their channel on Snapchat. You just shoot your camera at the snap and it does
and it's
its
like
thing.
Magic.
Yes. Thank you, Lucy.
Thank you, Lucy.
See you guys. Bye.
Have a good night. All right, feedback time. Brian wrote in to say, in regards to the gentleman you had on talking about the dash cam technology he was working on, there are systems already on the market. You don't just want to monitor red light infractions, but poor driving habits. At some point, Uber and Lyft, for that matter, are going to have to get ahead of this issue and start monitoring their drivers. Our office took a tour through a trucking company that uses a service where they have a camera in every truck. If there's a sudden motion swerving left or right or sudden deceleration, the camera will send the previous 30 seconds and continue sending the recording until the truck either stops or is back to regular motion. There are services like Janus Cam and Likes. Is it Likes Video Service? That's kind of hard to say. But there are services out there that aid in this. So good company, I suppose. Mm-hmm. All right, up next, thank you for writing, by the way. That's TNW at twit.tv if you have thoughts and you want to let us know. Up next, we check in on the Senate hearings where technology's biggest players have been under the microscope all week. But first, we want to take a minute to thank the sponsor of this episode, and that's Grammarly. Grammarly's AI-powered products help people communicate more effectively. I actually have it running in my Gmail account, which is particularly useful here at work. I don't want to send out grammar mistakes in my emails to my professional contacts in particular. Grammarly makes it easy, almost as easy as just tapping that Grammarly button in the compose window, and it goes to work analyzing my text and correcting for me. Copy and paste any English text into Grammarly's online text editor if you like, or you can do what I did and install Grammarly's free browser extension for Chrome, Safari, and Firefox. Grammarly corrects hundreds of grammar, punctuation, and spelling mistakes while also catching contextual errors. That's really hard to pick up on usually. Improving your vocabulary and then also suggesting style improvements. Grammarly scans your text for common and complex grammatical mistakes. Things like subject-verb agreement, modifier placement, comma splice, weak adjectives. Nobody wants weak adjectives. Missing articles. Grammarly's powerful algorithms are developed by the world's leading linguists and language lovers. Improve your skills with Grammarly's detailed explanations for all your mistakes and weekly progress reports. If you want to check in and see how you're doing, maybe you're improving over time thanks to the advice you get through Grammarly. You can write confidently and mistake-free on Gmail, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and nearly anywhere else that you write on the web. Be sure to check out Grammarly's Facebook and Twitter accounts for fun grammar tips and discussions as well. You can follow along there. The Grammarly blog also offers daily tips and insights on how to improve your day-to-day writing to achieve your personal and professional goals. So check it out for yourself. Get started. You can join more than 10 million happy Grammarly Chrome users today. Just download Grammarly now for free. Just go to getgrammarly.com/twit. That's getgrammarly.com/twit, and we thank Grammarly for their support of Tech News Weekly. So it seems like never before has big tech found itself under such intense scrutiny here in the U.S. anyways, as it's seen all this week. Facebook, Google, and Twitter have all sat before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. The reason, of course, is how these networks have managed the many ways that fake news and Russian influence had any sort of effect on the 2016 presidential election. And joining us to talk about the Senate hearings is Roger Chang from CNET. Welcome to the show, Roger.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's great to get you back. It's been a while.
Yep.
So first things first, is there any doubt, according to what we've seen, particularly from these hearings, that Russia was involved in, let's say, weaponizing these services for political influence?
Yeah, at this point, after the 7 hours of testimony, I listened to I think all doubt is eliminated in regards to Russia's involvement in the U.S. elections, and beyond that, a point was made that a majority of the money being spent on ads came after the elections. So this is a campaign that's still going on now.
Right. It was effective before, and it continues to be effective until these technology companies make changes, which is kind of what this is all about. What has been the biggest criticism or focus in the hearings that's aimed at these companies and how they did business during this time and continue to do business?
A lot of the questions were involving the sort of vetting of the companies that were actually placing these ads. There were a lot of questions. Senator Al Franken in particular had a number of pointed questions about why these companies would take foreign currency, and specifically rubles, for political ads, which is not something you could normally do with traditional media. But and the thing of it is, these companies didn't have a great answer. While these folks were lawyers, a lot of times they were trying to break it down into sort of the technical nuance of why they should or shouldn't be taking foreign currency, when these senators really wanted yes or no questions or yes or no answers or clearer answers. And so I think that part of the process, they got a lot of those questions on that. I think the senators expressed a lot of frustration over the lack of answers there.
And so I know I was surprised, maybe I shouldn't have been, that they sent lowers instead of Mark Zuckerberg or Sheryl Sandberg or Jack Dorsey. I mean, was there, why do you think they didn't send their real people? It seemed a little bit like, I don't know, it seemed like they should have sent the people in charge.
Yeah, I'm convinced that eventually the CEOs or at least some of the C-level executives will show up. This is the third hearing, set of hearings they've had. There's a lot of back and forth, and we don't really know who, what the process is like, the negotiations ahead of time that resulted in these lawyers showing up. You could argue that at least from the, from Google and Facebook and Twitter's perspective, it's safer to send these lawyers because it's basically lawyers talking with other lawyers and they all kind of speak the same kind of legalese. You kind of saw it a little bit with these lawyers, but there's a culture clash, right, between Silicon Valley and DC and how they say things. And so I imagine for these executives, it is a lot safer to send the lawyers out there to talk.
Yeah, and the lawyers are well-versed in what they can or should say and what they shouldn't. And yeah, it saves them from getting themselves into trouble merely by saying the wrong thing, I suppose.
And these lawyers were basically, they were getting – Congress was grilling them, really just laying into these lawyers. And, if I'm the CEO, I'd rather send a lawyer to take the hit than go myself.
Absolutely. Is there any one company that you've seen throughout the course of the last few days that's faring better than the rest, or maybe conversely, one that's far more under the microscope compared to the others? Are they all pretty much on equal footing in this regard?
No, it was clear that Facebook really took the brunt of the questions. In fact, the lawyer Colin Stretch took the brunt of the questions, and he seemed to be like ringleader, answering a majority of the questions. Oftentimes, you heard Google and Twitter say, "I agree," "Yes," or "I concur." It was really the Facebook lawyer who answered a lot of the questions and really kind of stumbled a bit when he was pressed hard by some of the senators and the representatives who asked them several pointed questions.
I know. I mean, they kept asking the same question, which we always keep asking, like, are you a media company or are you a platform? And that, it's the same question we ask of Uber, like, are you a platform, or are you a transportation company? And, they basically said the same thing they've always said. It was, I don't know. I do think, I don't know what the answer is here. Like, there needs to be some regulation, but does regulation lead to like the lack of anonymity? Like, what are we giving away when we say, they should be regulated like television is regulated?
Yeah, I think that's part of the reason why these hearings are being held, right? I think Congress wants to determine whether or not regulations are necessary or what kinds of regulations need to be put in. And conversely, these companies are trying to show, they were trying to come to Capitol Hill to convince Congress that they don't need regulations, that they can regulate themselves. But you could hear a lot of the skepticism from the senators and representatives who sort of asked, like, well, if there are no regulations and we're just trusting you to enforce this yourselves, is there anyone is there an outside, you know, enforcer for this? And I mean, the answer is no. They immediately said no. Like, you just sort of have to trust us.
Mm-hmm. What, you know, there have been some things that they've been not willing to answer, things that come down to, you know, financial questions, namely how much they've made off of, you know, supporting some of this disinformation from those campaigns with legitimate ad sales, or how much money they're devoting to police the platforms. What does that tell you? Are they being sincere here? Do they have, like, do they have true intentions based on what you've seen to address this, or why are they deflecting on that?
Yeah, I mean, I did notice that a number of questions that they were asked, you know, what sort of the percentage of ads were, you know, percentage of legitimate ads were actually these ads from this Russian troll factory. They didn't have any good answers. And I don't know if they necessarily could have gotten them, but it was clear that they weren't fully prepared for this presentation. They weren't fully prepared for the hearings or for the kind of grilling that they got. And so it's, yeah, I think there was, it's frustrating because I think a lot of folks, including us, were looking for answers and we didn't really get them.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we're after we talked to you, we're talking to two guests of Berkeley students that made like a bot detector on Twitter. Like, it was, you know, I mean, they're very smart guys, but if like they could do it, why can't Twitter do it? I mean, I know we're talking about a little bit different because, you know, this is bots versus ads. But I mean, there is an extent of like, what, you guys are very smart. Why didn't you know this?
Yeah, and Twitter in particular, they said that 5% of its user base are bots, is what they said is broke down. That's far lower than what most estimates put it at. It's usually about 15%, and so I think and Congress pointed that out. And Twitter, the fact that Twitter couldn't really explain that discrepancy was again a source of frustration for a lot of people.
Yeah. Now, Mark Zuckerberg announced during yesterday's Facebook earnings that the company plans to invest so heavily, he says, in security that it's probably going to affect profitability. Do you think this is a tactic that all of these companies and probably more are going to begin to take? I mean, the looming threat of regulation, it seems to be getting bigger and bigger, that cloud. So they want to do everything they can to take care of it themselves so that the government doesn't step in to take care of it for them, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. The timing of that statement definitely wasn't a coincidence. They saw the heat they were getting, and Zuckerberg, yeah, you know, made a pretty firm commitment there, and a dramatic one, saying that it would cut into profits, and you know, he would be fine with that. And yeah, I think to your point, that's exactly what these companies are going to say, and hopefully do, to basically stave off any kinds of regulations. That's basically the worst nightmare for them.
Right. And then finally, of course, now you have folks who are in the Senate hearing following this closely. Like, is it wrapping up at this point? What comes next at this stage?
So the hearings have wrapped up. Yeah, my reporter is actually back from D.C. already. And I believe there are more meetings, and I think they're waiting for at this point answers to all the follow-up questions that the congressman asked. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I think that investigation keeps rolling forward. And then I believe the committee is supposed to make a report eventually, but they're still waiting for additional facts and information from these companies.
Well, it's an interesting time for big technology right now. There's a lot of shift happening in kind of public perception of these companies and whether they're good, they have good intentions, or whether they're just out to make money or whatever, along with this, you know, this kind of government scrutiny. Everything seems to be changing right now. So it's a fascinating topic, whether you appreciate the politics aspect of it or not. Big changes happening in technology. We really appreciate you coming on to talk about it. Roger Chang from CNET.com. Thank you again, Roger. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Have a great night. All right. Now, you mentioned this just a few moments ago. Once upon a time, bots were all the rage. In fact, that time was not very long ago, but in the past year, many have been disillusioned by bots as they've been constantly associated with troll farms and being the tools of those who might hope to influence social media minds and spread their own messages of propaganda. They've proven to be very effective in that regard. But figuring out who or what's a bot online isn't always that easy. And joining us is Ash Bhatt and Rohan Fateh, two UC Berkeley computer science students who are working to expose these kinds of bots accounts for what they are. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Absolutely. It's great to get you both here. We appreciate you hopping on to talk to us about your work. So first of all, What is it about these bot accounts that makes them so difficult to discern to the average Twitter user? What would you say?
Yeah, they're pretty sophisticated in the sense that they're employing a lot of tactics that wouldn't seem like a bot at first glance. For example, they'll do things like mix moderated content, like where someone actually tweets out with a bunch of automated content as well. So like at a first glance, you might just be like, oh, this is a guy who retweets a lot. And then you go in and you start looking at the retweets and you're like, these tweets were posted every 2 minutes for a whole day. Like there's no way a human did that. A lot of different things like that. We've also noticed really sophisticated things around compromised accounts. We've noticed that a lot of these bots were historically like human help or like accounts that were operated by humans before, and then they were turned into these they were compromised, bought, and then turned into like these bot accounts, which then have followers that are actually real humans who've been following their friends who've been compromised.
And then to add on to that, there's a lot of these accounts that are sometimes moderated, which means that they can be semi-automated accounts where they are like retweeting many of these political tweets in the network. But then there are times where a human will actually get onto the network and tweet some original content every now and then. So presumably to get around, just basic algorithms to catch these bots that are just, retweeting. So it makes it actually look like a real human.
That happened to me, actually. I got my Twitter handle in 2008, and then I never used it for years and years and years until, 2015. And sometime in that point, there was, it had been compromised. My password had been stolen, and there were tweets that were, just getting coffee at Starbucks in my minivan.
That's not crazy. Me.
And so, I've seen that happen. So what inspired you to create this project? Rohan, let's start with you. What inspired you to create this?
Yeah, so actually back in May, Ash and I were working on this. We actually tried building another detector, and this was a detector for Facebook. And what we noticed is that there was a lot of this talk about fake news, a lot of news, basically a lot of news was on Facebook. And a lot of people thought that this was disingenuous. There were a lot of claims against that Facebook was promoting this fake news. So what we decided to do is we tried to build a classifier that would identify these news articles and put our own input. We would actually research this stuff up and identify the user if this was fake news or not. We'd also try to give a political bias estimate of these articles as well, so that users could be informed whether they're only listening to one side of the story or the other, and hopefully that they would be able to reach out and check the other side as well. And we basically had this algorithm on Facebook, and from there, we got a lot of attention there, and a lot of people really loved the tool. We decided to move on to other social networks, and one of the other things we tried to apply it to was Twitter. But one of the problems with just applying it to Twitter was that we had these accounts that were, I guess, kind of making the algorithm give out some really weird answers, really weird results. There were some very, very politically charged accounts. And upon further inspection, we saw that these accounts were seemed to be very non-human-like. They were constantly, again, like Ash said, constantly retweeting some of these fake news stories or propaganda accounts, news very, very quickly. And so we, upon looking further into this, we saw that this was actually just a new class of accounts. And from there, we built a new, do some research, build a new classifier so we could help users identify some of these accounts.
And of course, a lot of the work that you've done, at least on the Twitter side of things, has resulted in a Google Chrome browser extension called botcheck.me. Tell us a little bit about what that's doing behind the scenes, how that's kind of how that's such an effective tool.
Yeah, definitely. So what's happening with botcheck.me is that we have a website and a Chrome extension. You can install the Chrome extension and it'll start applying these buttons to all the tweets on Twitter. You can hit the button and it'll essentially tell you what our prediction is. But essentially what's happening in the background behind this Chrome extension is we have a server running a machine learning model. Essentially what happens when you type in a username is we hit the Twitter API, get all of their information. We featureize the heck out of the information that we get. So we're looking at several hundred different characteristics. So that this goes from the created at date. We're looking at bio, hashtags. And then we also break down the actual tweets themselves, and then we featureize those. So we'll take out really commonly like tweeted hashtags, and we have a whole thing where like we take all your last 200 tweets and turn them into like just a ton of characteristics. And from there, we vectorize that, and we're able to feed that into our machine learning model, which then outputs a result, which we serve to our user.
And what about false positives? I imagine it's not 100% accurate. So how do you deal with that and recognizing that?
Yeah. Do you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. So yeah, we have some false positives, and a lot of these, for the most part, it seems pretty good. We've had a couple thousands of queries, and for the most part, we've seen most people seem to be like agreeing with the results. But we do have the idea is that you can hit a disagree button on the Chrome extension, and the mod will take that into account, and the model will essentially learn from these different accounts that are being misclassified, and we can get a better and better model as this goes on.
Yeah, and like the really cool thing about it is that in the past day, the model has actually learned. So we launched like I guess 48 hours ago now, and like in that time period, people have been hitting that disagree button, and we've been applying heuristics to just look at these like users that have been disagreeing with our model, and then applying those changes to a new training set, which we then like have outputted as a new model. So like you'll notice that the accuracy continues to improve as more and more people use it.
We should be specific that these are like propaganda bots or not. I mean, there's some bots that are good. Like I have a yeah. lot of bots that I follow that remind me to take a drink of water when I'm on Twitter too much, or tell me when Donald Trump likes a tweet, just because sometimes I get entertained by that. So there are some good bots.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great clarification. Yeah, this is very specific in the sense of what this goes after. This is going after political propaganda on Twitter. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like you said, there are other cool bots. They're like, I think mentioned there's a bot that tweets out every word in the English language. It's kind of like a funny little test bot. There's a lot of these other bots out there that are mostly harmless, but we want to isolate on the true problem, which are these political propaganda accounts, which have in some cases been taken over by legitimate accounts. And so someone that you may have followed 4 years ago is now tweeting some of these political propaganda, some of it's fake news. And as you're scrolling down, you might see this news and you might actually believe some of the cases. So we just want to make sure that these users who are using Twitter can understand what's going on in their network and what are the news that they see.
Have you, in your work in this regard, have you heard from Twitter? I mean, it's kind of surprising that that Twitter wouldn't be doing something like this on its own. Are they aware of the work that you're doing, and have they been involved with you at all?
Yeah, so like that's one thing we've been a little bit confused by. We've had quite a bit of great outreach from a few different Silicon Valley companies. Like before and like after, like just in terms of like saying congratulations, great work, things like that. But not a peep from Twitter so far.
That's really funny. I mean, did they know that you were invited to WWDC when you were 16 years old, Ash?
I don't know.
And that you had dinner with Steve Wozniak?
Yeah, that was several years ago. Yeah,
we're helping your public knowledge of your profile.
I want to talk about this, but we read about you in this great profile in Wired, and I loved your story because you guys met when you were in like junior high, right, or elementary school, taking junior high classes.
Yeah, that's right. So we were both in we knew about each other in like elementary school. There was like a small group of kids that like would take like these junior high classes, but we met in junior high. We both had like a ton of shared classes in junior high, and like we've just known each other since.
Yeah, a lot of shared interests as well.
And did you both hack Snapchat, or was that just one of you?
Yeah, that was just me. But like that was a super interesting and weird like hackathon.
So was that a hackathon? And did you not expect that you were going to actually be able to hack them? Tell us that story.
Yeah, so Snapchat just always got a bad rap for all the spam that it had like back in the day. And so I was just kind of curious as to like how bad their security really was. And so like I gave it 6 hours. My team and I were just looking through like their APIs, and we were looking through like how the app was structured, and we figured out how to create accounts programmatically. And essentially there was like a sponsor there called DigitalOcean, and they were giving out free like DigitalOcean credits. And so we used these credits. We paralyzed a bunch of instances where we were just creating a bunch of Snapchat accounts, and then we sent snaps to every single user on Snapchat at the time.
Wow. That's impressive. That is impressive. That's some power right there. So you've dubbed this collaboration, or at least your collaboration together, Robot or Robot Labs?
It's Robot.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Which is awesome. I don't know if that's an unofficial name, but it's very clever. Where do you envision this whole thing going from here? You've had your hands in a number of kind of bot efforts at this point. Is that kind of your focus going forward right now?
Yeah, as of now, that is our focus. We really want to be impactful in the different tech that we develop. And like we've been really happy with like the impact we've been able to make. And with Botcheck Me, it's just really like satisfying to see like we've just gotten such an outreach of like support from like the Twitter community. And like it's really cool to think of this as like the community itself taking a problem that Twitter isn't solving into their own hands and actually actively making like getting more transparency and like solving this problem for themselves.
I'm really excited to see what you guys do next. And I'm not saying you're going to be called in front of the Senate for any hearings, but when you do, you guys should go. Don't send your lawyers, okay?
They're like, I don't know if I want to do that, actually.
That's a
pretty raw deal.
Everyone should go read the profile on Wired and yes. Go check out their website, botcheck.me. You guys are, I know, going to do something amazing next.
Yeah, you guys are doing some great work. Ashbot and Rohan Fateh, really appreciate you taking time to talk with us today. Thank you, guys.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much. Yeah.
Absolutely. Care. Keep up the good work. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye. And finally tonight, Silicon Valley star Kumal Nanjiani says he's met a lot of people creating new tech, and none of them are asking the important questions. In a tweet storm this week, Nanjiani said he has seen tech that violates privacy and has other ethical implication, and then it's being made just because it can be made, even though perhaps it should not be made. And he adds, at the rate that this is being developed, this tech, there is no way that laws or humanity can keep up.
Oof.
Just to end on a
yeah, I know. Note. Usually yeah. We end on an upside.
I know. My other story choice was that Aibo's coming back, the robot dog, so maybe that was a better choice to end
yeah,
on.
Yeah, robot dog would have been fine.
But yeah, this is an interesting tweet storm. I think it's stuff that we cover a lot, that we talk about. And I do think, I mean, when you see, like, obviously Ash and Rohan are, like, the next generation of entrepreneurs, I think, and they're obviously thinking about this stuff. So maybe this, we've passed the stage of people not thinking about the implications.
Yeah, what he points out in particular that kind of resonated with me is this general perception of Silicon Valley or the tech industry making things by asking the question, can we do this, and not asking the question, should we do this? And I mean, I get that, right? Like we feel that when we see some of these things that overstep a privacy boundary, or, you know, for a number of different things that are happening right now, there's this sense of like, yeah, well, technology, you can really make this do so many things, but is it the right choice? And I think the rationalization often comes down to this idea that if we don't do it, someone else is going to. So we might as well be the ones that benefit from it, you know, and there's always someone making that ethically, you know, feeling okay with making that ethically questionable thing, whatever it may be. And so it's hard to get everybody on the same page to say, hey, everybody, don't do that thing. That just won't happen, which is not justification for it to happen. That's just an illustration of the challenge. And I don't know what the solution is on that. It's an impossible challenge. It's kind of the predicament that we've found ourselves in as technology has become more and more powerful. And artificial intelligence is a piece of that. It's amazing what AI can do. But it's also kind of scary what that leads to.
Well, it makes me think of journalism. I mean, I think that, you know, there used to be more standards in journalism. And I think there are still higher standards in journalism. We'd rather be right than first.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's a lot of people that just want to be first out there. You know, a lot of websites that just want to be first. So I think, I mean, when you think about, them being able to create something that is, you know, won't ruin the world. I mean, specifically the stuff that we've talked about a lot that we kind of gloss over, that like Photoshop for video.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Like make, you know, Barack Obama be look like he's saying something he's not saying. Like that is kind of the stuff he's talking about.
That's a huge example of this, which, you know, from a technological perspective and a technology nerd perspective, that's really cool. I'm very interested to see that happen because it's crazy that you can do that. But then you take that into that ethical territory where it's like, yeah, but you've now just created a tool that forces everyone to doubt everything they see online. Mm-hmm. And that's a crazy world to be venturing into. I don't know what the right answer is on that.
I don't either.
Maybe you do. So email us, tnw@twit.tv. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at around 2:30 p.m. Pacific. You can be part of the show by emailing us, like I said, tnw@twit.tv. And you can subscribe to the show at twit.tv/tnw.
And we want to know what your favorite segments are, moments from Twit this year. It could be this show, could be any other show, other shows we've done. We're putting together our best of episodes and we want your help. So go to twit.tv/best of, fill out the form with whatever information you remember, and you can be part of making these special shows that will air the week between Christmas and New Year's.
Nice.
And if you want to tweet at me with all your answers to the ethics in Twit in tech question, or ethics at Twit, that too is fine. I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to everyone who helps out on the show. Thanks to Josh, our TD. Thanks to Burke helping out here in the studio. Thanks to Jammer B. Thanks to Colleen. And thanks to you as for always watching. We appreciate it. And we'll see y'all next week. Another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody. Hey, Bleak from the chat room just gave us a review on the iPhone X. Mm-hmm. I think this is required viewing for anyone interested.
So here you have it, iPhone in all of its iPhone XE glory. So it is a fingerprint magnet, as you can see.
Oh, man.
Pretty ridiculous. The most important thing is an emoji.
So most important thing.
Gonna be robot? Should I be the robot?
Yeah.
It's a bit hard to capture while you're doing it. Let's try the cat. How are you, Mr. Cat? Ooh, the cat's quite cute. You ever wonder what Bleak looks like? This is what Bleak looks like. An emoji cat.
Now I know what Bleak sounds like.
That's this is awesome.
Stupidly fun. I am quite a fan. Should we see the dog? We'll get the dog going. That's pretty funny. Yeah, it's pretty funny. What else we got in here?
Apple.
The ever popular poop. Pretty funny.
Apple Store employees must love this because everybody comes in there and
flop my bunny ears around.
They do exactly this.
Flop my bunny.
Make a fool of themselves.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
So, was an emoji worth $1,500? Probably. Have fun, guys.